content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Ann Jordan for the North Carolina Reading Service, and welcome to Oprah Magazine. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah.com. Okay, this first article is called Michelle Obama Answers 20 Questions for O Magazine. And there's a picture of Michelle Obama smiling. Her hair is down. She's wearing a necklace and an off-the-shoulder sweater. To celebrate 20 years of O, the Oprah Magazine, each issue, we're spotlighting visionaries, remarkable people who could change the way we look at the world. You want to be Michelle Obama's friend. That's understandable. She's a person of wholly admirable intelligence, grace, kindness, and dedication to making the world a better place. Of course, Michelle Obama would be the first one to downplay that kind of hype about Michelle Obama, but A, she won't read this until it's in print, so she can't stop me, and B, some people live up to the hype. One of the most remarkable things about the First Lady is that if you're lucky enough to spend time with her, you'll feel like maybe you could be her friend. She seems to accept her place in history without letting it define her or dictate her behavior. Despite her extraordinary achievements and experiences, she's ordinary folk. She's fun. She's funny. She shares her fires. She'll get in a blanket for a comedy hit, then punch you on the shoulder like a sister for sassing her. She'll ask you to call her Michelle, and someday you might have the guts to do it. In her memoir, Becoming, she candidly discusses the challenges she'd faced in her life and her feelings about what life has become for her and her family. Millions read it and were moved by her honest and open humanity. On her Becoming tour, I saw what her story means to tens of thousands of people here and abroad. Now, does that last sentence imply that I traveled with Michelle Obama? Yes, it does. Because while I admire her motto, when they go low, we go high, I've yet to attain it. The point is, I'm not saying Michelle Obama and I are friends, but even if I did, I think she's nice enough not to publicly contradict me. Michelle Obama and I are friends. 20 questions for Michelle Obama. Number one, what is your no-fail, go-for-it motivational song? Signed, sealed, delivered, I'm Yours by Stevie Wonder, even after hearing the song hundreds of times at Barack's campaign events. Number two, what's most important for your mental health? Not looking at too much social media. Number three, who's your hero? My mom, Marian Robinson. She's always been my rock, my guiding light through whatever fog was clouding my path, and she's quick with a joke just when I need to laugh. Number four, if you could send a note to yourself in 2030, what would it say? She says, I hope you're still waking up every morning excited by the possibilities of who you might become. I hope you never think you're done growing. Number five, what's the one thing in life you're so happy that you did? She says, getting married and having kids. Life with Barack, Malia, and Sasha has been one grand adventure. And I'm so proud of the two brilliant, bold young women that Barack and I raised. Number six, who's the one person who changed your life? She says, see above. Before I met Barack, I was all about checking off that next box. Law school, law firm, nice car. But he taught me the art of the swerve, how to take life as it comes and follow your passions wherever they lead. Number seven, what gives you hope? She says, all the essential workers who are risking their lives on our behalf during this crisis give me hope, as do the people across America who are stepping up to help, from checking in on their neighbors to bringing groceries to folks in need. Number eight, what the world needs now is, she says, for all of us to look out for each other. This pandemic is teaching us how interconnected we really are. And long after this is over, I hope we can remember that we are so much stronger when we're working together. Number nine, what's your favorite place on earth? She says, right now it's my home. It's been an adjustment, but I'm so grateful to be able to do the work I'm passionate about and catch up with my girlfriends just fine from my living room. Number 10, what should be required reading for every human? Michelle says, at least one novel by Toni Morrison. Every one of her stories demands that the world take the lives of Black girls seriously. We were so lucky to have her. Number 12, when in your life have you needed courage? I think we all need to be courageous right now. And whenever I have moments of fear or anxiety, I try to find ways to connect with others. I might call someone who I know is struggling and just let them know that I'm thinking of them. That simple act of reaching out lifts my spirits too. Number 13, cats or dogs? Oh, I don't know what I'd do without Beau and Sunny. 14, when is the last time you felt awe? She says, I traveled to Vietnam recently, and I'm still thinking about the incredible young women I met there, so determined to get an education despite unbelievable barriers. Number 15, what do you think about on long drives or flights? She says, honestly, I don't think about anything. I listen to music, or if someone else is around, I'm chatting them up, just passing the time. Sometimes you just gotta unplug, and I think airplanes are great for that. Number 16, what is your biggest pet peeve? Bullying. Number 17, what ignites your sense of injustice? Seeing young people denied opportunities because of who they are, too young, too dark, too poor, it's all infuriating, plain and simple. Number 18, how do you define soulmate? She says, someone who's committed to growing with you, who doesn't let you off the hook when you want to give up on a big dream or play it safe. Number 19, what's the greatest gift we can give ourselves? She says, letting go of external markers of success. Job titles and fancy awards come and go, but our lives are really made up of the little moments and connections in between. Number 20, what's the greatest gift we can give each other? She says, sharing our stories in all their messy, broken glory. When we stand in the truth of who we are, we invite others to do the same. Okay, this next article is from the section called Your Best Life, and it's called The Best Fall Candles for Your Zodiac Sign. It's time for some warm and spicy home scents. The photo shows a wooden wreath with little twinkle lights, and inside the wreath are three candles. One of the candles has one wick, and the other two candles have two wicks. It says, with the onset of fall, we're all craving warm and spicy flavors to align with the new season. One way to achieve that is filling our homes with cinnamon, apple, amber, and patchouli keynotes to seduce the senses. Those scents will keep us warm on the chilliest of days and nights with intoxicating essences and smells that will usher in cozy season on a high note. But if you're unsure whether you're more the smoky type or meant for the aroma of sweet baked goods, I've gone through some of the best fall candles out there and aligned them with your zodiac sign, because even the right mood for your home is written in the stars. If you are an Aries, the Amber Black Block candle might be a good fit for you. The Ram tends to run hot due to its innate vibrant nature, which is why they will be immediately drawn to the sensual, warm notes of this candle for fall. The fragrant essences of amber, musk, and honey will keep the passions of the Ram blazing high. And like the fiery sign of Aries, this candle will not burn out fast and last the test of time by keeping the desirous and tenacious energy ever flowing, as they like it. If you are a Taurus, you might like the Diptyque Feu de Bois wood fire candle. Taurus's earthy vibe makes them yearn for woodsy and grassy scents to fill up their homes. In fact, the bull would choose to live in the forest if they could, due to their deep relationship with and love of nature. An outdoorsy candle for fall will bring their favorite place to their abode, allowing them to enjoy this luxurious fragrance snuggled up in bed with their significant other, pets, or just their fabulous selves. If you are a Gemini, you might like the Illume Mercury Leaves Jar Candle. Gemini is known for their chatty and communicative nature, which is why a candle that resides in a glass mercury jar, Mercury is Gemini's planetary ruler, is the best pick for this inquisitive zodiac sign. This candle will illuminate truths and bring clarity to clandestine matters before gossip is spread. Not only that, but the scent will enable the airy sign to speak clearly and concisely. There is absolutely nothing more that Gemini can ask for from a candle. Cancer, warm apple pie candle. There is nothing that gets the crab going like the smell of fresh baked apple pie in the fall. The nostalgic aroma will take Cancer back in time by awakening their memories of autumnal fun, baking with family, apple picking, and decorating their home with seasonal accoutrement. Now that the delicious essence of their youth is available in candle form, the sentimental crab will want to buy several of these yummy candles to always have them at home. Leo, Ellington Luxury Candle. This spicy candle has essences of cinnamon, bergamot, rose, and patchouli, all of which will intoxicate the rambunctious lion's heart by inspiring them to implement their romantic and creative desires into reality. Upon lighting the wick of the Ellington Luxury Candle, Leo will feel as though they are being given the proper TLC to manifest their artistic visions this season. Now more than ever, the lion will want to roar their heart out with the help of this candle. If you are a Virgo, the Hive and Wick Ceramic Candle might be a good fit for you. It's time for Virgo to connect with themselves. This mutable sign will need to decompress and chill during the upcoming autumnal months, which will be hard for them to do. All the more reason why they'll be drawn to this healing and meditative candle that is composed of peppermint, eucalyptus, and herbal tea. The fragrance of oak moss leaf will allow Virgo to ground and center their energies while focusing on aligning their body, mind, and spirit together for maximum relaxation. The Libra may be drawn to the Boulangerie Jar Candle. Every Libra knows that sugar and spice can make everything nice, and that is why they will swoon when they smell this vanilla and fig candle, a seasonal fragrance that harmonizes juxtaposing essences together. The sweet and rich flavors will seduce their hearts and minds all autumn long. We can guarantee that this will be Libra's new go-to candle when they need comfort or some good old-fashioned love during the upcoming chilly days. If you are a Scorpio, you might like the Blessed and Fall-Obsessed Scented Candle. Always one to give their all to others and their favorite causes, Scorpios have a tendency to get deep into their projects very fast. Now it's time for them to put their zestful and intense sentiments to the test by blending them into their enjoyment of autumnal activities. This candle will harness their passionate drive into their favorite season all year round. Because let's face it, every Scorpio should feel blessed and fall obsessed every day, no matter what the season is. Sagittarius, the Capri Blue Pumpkin Clove Jar Candle. Little known fact, cloves are flower buds that are most associated with Jupiter, who is the planetary ruler of Sagittarius. Cloves are known to aromatically bring abundance and prosperity to those who smell the spicy scent. This is why Sagittarius will totally want to take a chance and gamble on this pumpkin candle that has traces of cloves, cinnamon, and vanilla in its base. The aromatic candle will prove to bring Sag luck this season and boost their upbeat attitude. Capricorn, Apothecary Collection Patty Wax Candle. No other scent is cozier for Capricorn than this candle's blend of amber and smoke. In true Capricorn tradition, the changing of the seasons and commencement of fall makes them think of the past, present, and future. This fragrance will keep the sea goat warm-hearted and affectionate even on the most chillest of autumnal days. Aquarius. The Southern California Homesick Candle. Aquarius has a deeply reflective side, which makes them tender at their core. This means one of their favorite pastimes is often wandering the beachfront with the salty air running through their hair while staring at the sea and reminiscing about the past. While we can't guarantee that Aquarius will be homesick in the upcoming months, we absolutely know that the citrusy, floral, and breezy scent of this candle will take this deeply pensive sign back in time on a sentimental journey. And last we have Pisces, the Protection Crystal Energy Candle. Being one of the most sensitive signs of the zodiac, Pisces picks up on the energy of people very quickly, which is not necessarily a good thing. Luckily, this amethyst-charged candle will protect the mystical waterside from negativity and ensure that all of the bad vibes they're feeling from others bounce right off of them. It'll also restore peace and calmness within, while rejuvenating the auric field of Pisces and bring nothing but positive vibes their way. Okay, here's an article called Chrissy Teigen Sharing Her Pregnancy Loss Helps Women Like Me Feel Less Alone. Experiencing miscarriages and stillbirths shouldn't be some sad secret society. The photo shows Chrissy Teigen in the hospital with her husband, John Legend. She is wearing some sort of mask, like a ventilator mask to help her breathe. And her husband, John Legend, is clasping her hand. His eyes are closed and he's resting his head on her shoulder. My husband and I were watching Netflix when a push notification appeared on my phone. I gasped. Chrissy Teigen had lost her baby boy. I immediately stopped paying attention to the show, tearing up as I saw details of the placental issues, blood transfusion, epidural, and ultimately baby loss that Teigen and her husband John Legend endured. More pain than any human being should have to go through. It's a pain that I can relate to. And it's a pain that I, too, shared with my social media followers. Of course, Teigen is already catching flack for sharing something so private so publicly. Why not just endure the trauma silently, stoically? Many have wondered in various comment sections across the internet. But I know personally just how cathartic sharing your losses can be, even with strangers. Weirdly, despite our culture's extreme openness, miscarriage and baby loss have only recently become less taboo to talk about. And because it is so common, it's something we need to talk about even more. As I type this article one-handed, my 5-year-old daughter is doing a Zoom kindergarten in the living room. In my lap is my 5-month-old, my miracle baby. Over the course of 2.5 years, I went through 3 traumatic pregnancy losses back to back, as well as a chemical pregnancy, before I finally made it successfully through all 3 trimesters to her birth. I'd gotten pregnant easily with my older daughter, so I was not emotionally prepared for the extended trauma of multiple losses. First, at 9 weeks, there was a missed miscarriage, which means the baby's no longer viable, but your body doesn't realize it. That led to a DNC operation at a surgery center to remove the fetus. They were able to test the DNA, a daughter. Next, there was a natural miscarriage at 6 weeks, the embryo slipping from my body in the bathroom of a movie theater. After 6 months of testing, specialist, blood draws, ultrasounds, vitamins, and fertility conversations, I received a green light to try again. It had simply been bad luck, they said. I immediately got pregnant with my other baby, my 4th in 4 years. But 9 weeks later, as my husband and I sat in an ultrasound room at my doctor's office, our hands clasped, my lips whispering prayers, we discovered I'd had yet another missed miscarriage, the most traumatic by far. After a conversation with my doctor, I elected for pills to expel the fetus in the privacy of my home, spending that evening hunched over in pain, alternating between the bathroom and a distracting The American's Marathon on the couch. The pills didn't take, and so I needed another DNC a full 5 weeks later, which I elected for same day in office at UCLA without anesthesia. I simply wanted the pain gone and the nightmare over. They tested the tissue. Another daughter. A lifetime erased. But finally, a happy ending. After a full year of secondary infertility following the third baby loss, I got pregnant for the fifth time. Well, six if you count the chemical pregnancy. That pregnancy was perfect. Textbook. Not a single issue other than the incessant, gnawing terror that plagued me at all hours, worried for my baby's well-being. I enthusiastically liked and commented on other people's pregnancy announcements, but I uncharacteristically kept my own pregnancy under wraps until I was 36 weeks along, out of the pure fear of jinxing it. After all, I'd taken friends and followers along on each stage of my journey with previous babies, even posting a photo from UCLA immediately post-DNC, desperately wanting to feel less alone. When I finally revealed the good news on my Instagram, my belly enormous, my five-year-old proudly grinning, it was my most liked and commented upon post ever. People I didn't even know were flooding my account with ecstatic well wishes and grateful prayers and telling me how they've been rooting for our eventual baby success, because it gave them hope for themselves too. And there is a photo of the Instagram post. It shows the author of this article in profile with a hugely pregnant belly, with her hands on her belly, and she's smiling and laughing with her daughter, who appears to be about 4 years old in this photo. She has long sandy blonde hair, and she's wearing a little dress with some Disney princesses on it. And in the background is a sign saying, "Life is an adventure. Be brave." The caption on the photo reads, "We've spent 9 months terrified to jinx it, anxious in these uncertain times, not ideal to be giving birth during a pandemic, but also full of hope for the future. No baby has ever been more wanted. Hashtag 36 weeks." People who have been through the miscarriage and stillbirth trenches know that it's like being in the saddest secret society, something nobody wants to be a member of. But it does bond you to others who have been through the grief, too. The losses change you forever. And in those darkest moments when you're trying to dig yourself out of the bottomless pit of existential despair, it genuinely helps to connect with others, even strangers. Who can relate? You already feel so alone. Sharing your pain lightens the load. Like many grieving parents, Tegan and Legend named their baby Jack. At the advice of my OB, mine had names too. August, Hope, Ella Rose. And finally, my beautiful, incredible miracle baby. A dream made real. Her name is Charlotte. She's 5 months old. And she wouldn't be here if we hadn't walked that hard road. My heart aches for Tegan and Legend, but I applaud them for bravely sharing their story. People saying they shouldn't be sharing are missing the point. They've already helped countless other grieving people realize that they're not the only ones to experience such a horrifying loss. And I wish them every happiness in the future, private and public, social media trolls and armchair quarterbacks be damned. Okay, this article is called "I Got Laid Off in a Pandemic, and Cooking My Grandmother's Recipes is Saving Me." Making classic Dominican meals alongside my abuelita has been an unexpected therapy. The photo shows two sets of women's hands, a younger set of hands and an older set of hands, and they're both ripping up some lettuce and tossing it into a wooden bowl. Grano a grano se llena la gallina el buche. It's a saying my grandmother loves to say whenever someone is in the process of working towards a goal. Grain by grain, the hen fills the stomach. And they are words she's saying to me a lot these days. In late March, I was laid off from my job as a deputy editor for a women's lifestyle site. It's been the longest time I've gone without a job since I graduated college during the recession of 2009. So during the pandemic, I've been working toward the goal, grain by grain, of finding full-time employment while also managing the anxiety around making sure I stay healthy as well as my family. And I found a form of therapy during this time in an unexpected place, the kitchen. I didn't take losing my job personally. My former company, like many others, took a significant financial hit as a result of COVID-19. I'm certain it had nothing to do with my performance and everything to do with what's happening in the world right now. In fact, I'm just one of 32 million Americans collecting unemployment benefits as of June 26, according to the U.S. Labor Department. And I didn't just lose my job. When the Harlem apartment I shared with my two roommates came up for lease renewal in July, with no guarantee that we'd have steady jobs anytime soon, temporarily moving back home with our families just seemed like the best financial bet for all three of us. It was a lot of change and uncertainty at once. Being laid off and quarantined at home is a scary combination. Yet when friends call to check in on me and see how I'm doing, they're often surprised at my optimistic response. I'm in good spirits, I tell them. I feel joyful. I'm working out, writing, and I'm cooking. Staying positive has been a choice, and one that staying physically and being creative have definitely helped with. But it's been cooking classic Dominican meals alongside my abuelita that has saved me. The photo shows an older woman wearing a top that's embroidered with a sort of pattern, and she's holding up what appears to be a daiquiri glass with a little paper decorative umbrella, and she's got painted red fingernails. She is wearing a mask, like to protect herself in the pandemic, and she's wearing white pants. Anyone who has ever been laid off knows how easy it can be to let your mind spiral into negative thoughts. But during a pandemic, the risk of falling into a deep state of anxiety or depression are high. Even before I lost my job, when New Yorkers were instructed to shelter in place in March, I instantly challenged myself to get through this without becoming an anxious mess. I quickly came up with a process. First, I would dedicate time every morning to meditate and count my blessings. So far, no one in my family has been seriously affected by COVID-19, despite the fact that both of my parents and a number of my relatives are essential workers. The second thing I was going to do was work out every single morning to maintain my health and work towards building my immune system. I also decided I would read more books and freelance to get my byline out there while I continued to apply for full-time editor jobs. And lastly, to keep my spirits high, I said, I will cook. Back when I was in Harlem, I would cook for my roommates, almost always one of my grandmother's recipes. One night, it was sancocho, a hearty stew made with numerous kinds of meats. Another night, it was pastelón de plátano maduro, a sort of Dominican lasagna made with sweet plantains. And other nights, it would be more typical dishes, like rice and beans with pollo guisado, stewed chicken. Every meal made me feel closer to home, closer to my abuela, and it reminded me of what really mattered: community, family, and human connection. When I moved back home with my parents and Abuela Celeste, I was instantly in even better spirits, because now I had the opportunity to cook alongside the muse herself. And the cooking process became an even bigger project for me as I worked to make meals that would keep my family healthy by cutting our meat and sugar intake and moving toward a more pescatarian diet. Recreating Abuela's recipes without meat was a challenge that we both enjoyed. Every afternoon in the kitchen became an experiment, an adventure, and an opportunity to hear her stories. Fridays soon became bacalao con mangú days. In the Dominican Republic, bacalao is a very typical dish, a salted codfish often sautéed with red onions and peppers. Mangú is a traditional Dominican side of mashed plantains. Bacalao is popular in the Dominican Republic now, but growing up it was considered a dish for the poor because it was a lot more affordable than meat and even other fishes, Abuela told me in Spanish, once as we stood side by side in the kitchen. The reason why most folks eat it, either with mangú or steamed yuca, is because it was cheaper to boil the root vegetable than buy a bag of rice. And there's two photos side by side. They're each dishes cooking. On the left, there's a pan full of vegetables and broth, and there's a spoon that's just dipping in to stir it. And on the right is a pan of vegetables. This one doesn't really have broth. It's just like a pile of veggies. Abuela says I inherited a lot from her. She says I have her joyful spirit, her love and her appreciation of people, and her skills in the kitchen. You're like me, she tells me. You're passionate about cooking, and that is why your food tastes so good. I love cooking, even at 92. Because when you're cooking, you forget everything else that is happening. It forces you to slow down and be patient. One afternoon, Abuela and I sat next to each other at the kitchen table to enjoy lunch. I was overwhelmed with appreciation for the moment, for the unexpected time I've had with her and my family during one of the scariest times in history. Eventually, I'll get a good job, and I'll move into an apartment of my own. There's no doubt about that. Though it looks like it's sticking around for a while, I know that this virus is not going to be here forever. So, in the meantime, I'm making the best of this time, even if it means being unemployed and living back at home. What will we cook tomorrow? Abuela often asks me. I always tell her with a smile, I don't know yet, but I'm sure we'll come up with something tasty. This next article is called Eva Mendez Says She Likes Being a Homebody with Her Husband, Ryan Gosling. Rather be home with my man than anywhere else in the world. The picture shows Eva Mendez. She has some sort of black head wrap and dangly earrings, and she's standing next to husband Ryan Gosling. He's wearing a white collared shirt and a tweed blazer. Ryan Gosling and Eva Mendez have been a couple for over 9 years and share two daughters, 6-year-old Esmeralda and 4-year-old Amada. In an interview with Kelly Clarkson, Mendez revealed that she and Gosling are controlling parents. Although they have kept their daughters away from the limelight, the two do share sweet tidbits from their life at home from time to time. In fact, in an interview with OprahMag.com, Mendez revealed that their children don't even know that she and Gosling are celebrities. But long before Mendez and Gosling were in full-on parenting mode, they were colleagues on the set of their 2011 movie, The Place Beyond the Pines. It was then that rumors about their relationship began swirling. But since they've managed to stay relatively mum on the details of their relationship, in her interview with OprahMag.com, Mendez did provide some clarity on one thing. Previous reports that the two first met on the set of their film are actually not true. There's such special work in The Place Beyond the Pines, she told us. We had known each other for a while already, so to work together was really exciting. Aha! So while we still don't know exactly how and when they met, we do know that their friendship began long before they were colleagues. And though since then they've rarely spoken publicly about their personal family life, they have gushed about one another from time to time. In an interview with Women's Health, Mendez revealed she didn't want to have children until Gosling came into her life. Ryan Gosling happened, she told the magazine in 2019. I mean, falling in love with him. Then it just made sense for me to have, not kids, but his kids. It was very specific to him. In a 2015 interview with People, Gosling also spoke candidly about what his life is like with Mendez and their two daughters. It sounds so cliche, but I never knew that life could be this fun and this great, he said. It's heaven. It's like walking through a field of flowers every day. I live with angels. Could these two sound any more enamored? In honor of their love, let's take a look at how Eva Mendez and Ryan Gosling's relationship began, and how their privacy has helped them stay strong through the years, all the way up through 2020. The photo shows them on the set of A Place Beyond the Pines. They appear to be in a restaurant. Ryan's hair is dyed blonde. He has tattoos all over his arms. He's wearing a blue faded t-shirt. And the two of them are facing each other, and his hands are on top of hers. She's wearing a lot of bracelets, and her hair is up in a ponytail. In The Place Beyond the Pines, Gosling and Mendez played a former couple who share a son. During the time they were shooting the film, the two were spotted on a date at Disneyland in California. Photos of the moment, of course, quickly made the tabloid rounds. According to Us Weekly, the two held hands the majority of the time, sparking rumors that they were indeed a couple. In 2012, Mendez and Gosling starred in Funny or Die's Drunk History Christmas. We got a small glimpse at how Mendez and Gosling might look when they sleep in bed together, when they starred in Funnier Die's Drunk History Christmas skit together as a couple. Talk about art imitating life. In May 2012, Mendez could not stop giggling when Ellen DeGeneres asked her about Gosling. At this point, neither Mendez nor Gosling had confirmed they were actually together, but based on the paparazzi pictures of them, arm-in-arm in cities around the world, it was safe to say they were in a relationship. Mendez made it even more obvious when she stopped by the Ellen DeGeneres show and could not stop laughing when Ellen kept trying to pry her for details about their relationship. In 2014, sources confirmed that Gosling and Mendez were expecting a child together. In April 2016, Mendez and Gosling welcomed their second child together. Though neither Mendez or Gosling ever confirmed she was pregnant again, in April the couple welcomed another daughter, Amada Lee. The couple chose to give their littlest one the same name as her older sister's middle name. My grandmother's name is Amada, and Esmeralda Amada is the name of our oldest. We had a few names picked out for our new baby, and when she was born, we just didn't feel like those names were her. We came up with a few more, even that morning. We tried them out. We were like, what about Viviana? But we just kept going back to Amada. Just 2 weeks before Mendez gave birth, her older brother Carlos Mendez passed away after a long battle with cancer. It was an emotional time with the passing of my brother. We thought how beautiful to go with what made us emotional and with what felt like her. When we looked at her, we thought, oh, Amadita. Mendez admitted she explained to Gosling that their daughter sharing the name was not unusual in her culture. In true Latin fashion, we reuse names all the time, she said. I actually told Ryan this is common in Latin culture, so it really wouldn't be crazy. While accepting the Golden Globe for Best Actor in a Musical or Comedy for La La Land, Gosling gave a shout-out to the mother of his children, who was home with their two young daughters, and mourning the loss of her brother. You don't get to be up here without standing on the shoulders of a mountain of people. There's no time to thank everyone. I would like to try to thank one person properly and say that while I was singing and dancing and playing piano and having one of the best experiences I have ever had on film, my lady was raising our daughter, pregnant with our second, and trying to help her brother fight his battle with cancer, he said. If she hadn't taken all that on so I could have this experience, it would surely be someone else up here instead of me. So, sweetheart, thank you. To my daughters, Amada and Esmeralda, I love you. And if I may, I would like to dedicate this to the memory of her brother, Juan Carlos Mendez. All right, this next article is called Amazon Prime Day 2020 is coming. Here's what we know about the year's biggest deals. Mark your calendar. It's October 13th and 14th. If you're like us, you A, consider yourself a particularly savvy shopper, and B, love a great sale, and C, are on a first-name basis with your Amazon delivery driver, which is exactly why we've been waiting anxiously for the return of Amazon Prime Day. While the mega e-retailer's biggest sale of the year, Think, significantly slashed prices on everything from treadmills and laptops to TV stands and kitchen appliances, has traditionally happened in July, the annual event, like so many other things in 2020, was postponed in light of the COVID-19 outbreak. The good news? There will be an Amazon Prime Day in 2020, and it starts at midnight PST on October 13th. To make sure you don't miss a single steal during the two-day shopping extravaganza, we have put together a Prime Day primer with everything you need to know about how, when, and where you can get the absolute best deals. Oh, and of course, we'll continue to update the story with information as we hear about it. Remind me, what is Amazon Prime Day? Introduced in 2015 as a way to celebrate the brand's 20th birthday, the first Amazon Prime Day was a 24-hour shopping spree that spanned 9 countries, including the US, Spain, Italy, and Japan. Since then, Prime Day has become Amazon's biggest sale of the year. Yes, it is even bigger than Black Friday or Cyber Monday. in which customers can expect deep discounts on thousands of items, from colorful nail polishes to super soft bedding to stylish sneakers to chic coats and the most useful baking essentials. Now, despite the name, Amazon Prime Day is not always one day. As the annual marathon of deals has grown in popularity, it's also grown in length. In 2017, it lasted 30 hours. In 2018, it went for 36 hours. And 2019's Amazon Prime Day was the longest yet, lasting a full 48 hours. Like the 2019 Amazon Prime Day, the 2020 Amazon Prime Day will last a full 48 hours too. As we've learned the hard way, Amazon Prime deals sell out fast. Though keep in mind, new deals are added throughout the event. So to make sure you can snag your items in a timely fashion, first things first, double check that your membership and payment methods are up to date. You should also make sure that you have the Amazon app on your phone, which will allow you to track and even view some deals before they go live. Additionally, you will want to bookmark the 2020 Amazon Prime Day landing page, which is where all the items included in the sale should appear. Pro tip, make sure to check early and often so you can stay on top of the best deals. Are you feeling overwhelmed just by the thought of all these deep discounts? It can be helpful to make a wish list in the weeks leading up to the sale so you can prioritize what you're actually in the market for. What kind of sales can I expect? Okay, much like the date, Amazon tends to be tight-lipped about what specifically will be part of the Prime Day deals. So while we might not know yet what may be on sale during the Prime Day 2020, we can tell you about what we've seen in the past. Historically, Amazon has slashed prices on big-ticket home and tech items. Think Brooklinen sheets, Apple iPads, Vitamix blenders, and cult favorite Instant Pots, as well as Amazon-branded items like Kindle e-readers, Echo and Alexa devices, and Amazon Fire TV sticks. All right, here we have an article called Jane Elliott, creator of the Blue Brown Eyes Experiment, says racism is easy to fix. More than 50 years after her famous exercise, Elliott is still fighting. The racist carry on, so I carry on. The lives and legacies of Dr. Jane Elliott and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. are inextricably linked. On April 4, 1968, King was killed by the single bullet of a lone assassin as he stood outside room 306 on the second floor balcony of the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee. The reverberations of that fateful day would be felt the world over, but it was the following day that would change Elliot's life forever. It was then that the white school teacher in the all-white town of Riceville, Iowa, devised an exercise to enable her third-grade students to experience firsthand what prejudice, discrimination, and racism felt like. In what is now famously known as the Blue Eyes, Brown Eyes exercise, Elliott divided her class into two groups based on a characteristic over which they had no control: eye color. Blue-eyed students were placed in one group, and brown-eyed students in the other. Members of both groups were treated according to the color of their eyes. On the first day, Elliott convinced the brown-eyed students that they were better, smarter, and superior to their blue-eyed counterparts, and, as such, they were entitled to privileges such as more recess time and access to a water fountain. The next day, she reversed the rules. Elliott was astounded by the results. In a PBS documentary about her work entitled A Class Divided, she said, "I watched wonderful, thoughtful children turn into nasty, vicious, discriminating little third graders." For decades, Elliott repeated the exercise with elementary school students, college students, and professionals around the world, consistently finding that participants would turn against each other for no reason than the color of their eyes. Today, in 2020, Elliott still believes, as she did back in 1968, that white people keep feeling, thinking, and talking this racist way until they've experienced some of the treatment that people of color live with every day. At the time, the exercise was considered controversial, in part because, just for a few short hours, it forced white people to experience a semblance of the pain that black people do. For instance, it wasn't uncommon for white participants who likely hadn't experienced overt discrimination based on their skin color to abandon the exercise in fits of rage and sometimes even in floods of tears. Such was the perceived level of humiliation and powerlessness that they experienced. Overall, however, the exercise demonstrated that, if prejudicial, while discriminatory and racist behaviors can be learned, they can also be unlearned. In the wake of the police killing of George Floyd on Memorial Day, archival clips of Elliott's exercise began making rounds on social media, thrusting her anti-racism work back into the spotlight it had occupied 52 years prior. Particularly relevant in this racially charged climate, Elliott's experiential exercise is a palpable representation of discrimination in action. And more than five decades later, Elliott is still a force to be reckoned with. She says, as long as the hatred and the ignorance is going on, I, as an educator, have to keep going on. At 86 years old, the pioneer of the anti-racism exercise is still in demand, and she's as straight-talking, incisive, and quick-witted as ever. Speaking from her home in the rolling plains and cornfields of Iowa, the former schoolteacher turned anti-racism educator has not lost a step since she first hit TV screens in 1992 on The Oprah Winfrey Show. Despite being universally recognized as a creator of the famed exercise, Elliott is quick to refute this. Instead, she only lays claim to having adapted it. "I didn't create the exercise. I learned it from Adolf Hitler," she tells OprahMag.com matter-of-factly. "One way he decided who went into the gas chamber was by eye color. If you had a good German name, but you had brown eyes, they made sure you went to the gas chamber because they thought you might be a Jewish person who was trying to pass. They killed hundreds of thousands of people on the basis of eye color." Raised on a farm in northeast Iowa, Elliott was born in 1933, the same year that Hitler came to power. She often likens the current state of race relations in the U.S. to Hitler's exploits in Europe from 1933 to 1945. In adapting the exercise, Elliott says her intention was that anybody going through it would relate to what the Jews went through then and what blacks are going through now. "I wanted people to experience that and gain empathy. Not education, but empathy." But the uphill battle to defeat racism isn't just about lack of empathy. It's about economics. Prince Harry was recently quoted as saying, "When it comes to institutional and systemic racism, it's there, and it stays there, because someone, somewhere, is benefiting from it." Elliott agrees. "Racism is profit-making behavior," she says. She adds, "Read Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. Thanks to people like Bill Clinton, who started the 3 strikes and you're out nonsense, we put mostly young black males in prison. They're forced to work 8 hours a day, and in many cases, they're paid 20 cents an hour. It's a new form of slavery. Make no mistake about this, it is a way to make a lot of money." Whatever the reason for the perpetuation of racism, its harmful effects have long been well documented. In 1969, the Joint Commission on Mental Health of Children acknowledged that racism was America's number one public health problem among children. Tellingly, Elliott points out, they didn't say black children. They said all children. She continues, "Thinking your skin makes you superior is absolutely ridiculous. To think somebody else's skin color makes that person inferior is equally ridiculous, but much more harmful. Because if you think you're right and everybody else is wrong, and like our current president, you can get enough people to agree with you, you can destroy people of color on a daily basis. We do that all day in this country." Fast forward 51 years from the Joint Commission's report to 2020. In July, CNN shared findings from a study that revealed that racial discrimination may increase stress, lead to health problems, and hamper the cognitive function of black women. Why black women in particular? Elliott believes it's because their sons and husbands are in constant danger. As has been amply demonstrated over the past few months during wartime, we send black men to fight in our wars and die. In peacetime, we make war on them in this country. Black women know that. Despite her scathing assessment of the state of U.S. race relations, Elliot fervently believes that racism is easy to fix. She offers a two-part solution to the problem. The first is philosophical, and the second is practical. Step one, stop believing that there's more than one race. Realize that we're all members of the same race, the human race. She adds that from the age of 5 to 18, people are not educated, but rather indoctrinated, to believe in the myth of white superiority. But any myth can be debunked, and Elliot outlines the roadmap to destroy the myth of race using the same tool that was used to construct it, literature. I'd start by insisting that every child reads the book The Color of Man by Robert Cohen, she said. I'd also insist that every educator reads all the books listed in the bibliography on my website. Step two, change housing segregation practices. In an interview with Slate magazine, Richard Rothstein talks about his book, The Color of Law, a forgotten history of how our government segregated America. He rejects the idea that America's metropolitan areas are de facto segregated, that is, the product of private individuals' choices about where to live. According to Rothstein, most residential segregation can't be attributed to the private choices of homebuyers or even prejudices held by realtors and lenders, and the separation of many U.S. neighborhoods has been at the core of federal housing policy for decades. Elliot, too, believes that racially segregated neighborhoods in the U.S. are the product of de jure segregation, residential segregation that is mainly a consequence decided by law rather than a matter of personal choice among residents. Anybody who thinks that all residential segregation we have is de facto segregation is wrong. Believe me, this can be taken care of. We simply have to change these housing segregation practices. While Elliot shows no signs of calling time on her anti-racism activism, she does have her eyes firmly fixed on the future of the exercise that made her famous. She's even contemplating passing the torch to some of her family members so that they can follow in her footsteps, whether they choose to lead the exercise with third grade students, college students, professionals, or all of the above as Elliot did. I have a daughter who would be good at leading the exercise, so she's studying to do it. I also have three granddaughters who could lead it very well. Because they've listened to me a lot, they've learned some things that convince them that a lot of what they've learned is nonsense, she said. An essential part of the exercise, which Elliot says she hates, involves being unrelenting in her ridicule and humiliation of the inferior group. Subjecting them to discriminatory statements like, brown-eyed people are better than blue-eyed people, this is a fact. According to Elliot, white women have to lead the exercise because people won't listen to black women. Coming from a man, no one is going to put up with the kinds of things I say during the exercise. They'll take it from a woman. They'll take it from a white woman. Ultimately, Elliot is shocked and saddened that the need for her anti-racism exercise is as pressing in 2020 as it was in 1968. For her, she says it's a bit like watching the movie Groundhog Day, where the main character wakes up in the morning only to realize he's reliving the same day again and again. So what motivates Elliot to continue her anti-racism endeavors? What motivates the racist to carry on, she asks in response. The racist carry on, so I carry on. When they stop, I will. All right, this next story is called Lenny Kravitz Says He's Tight with His Ex-Wife Lisa Bonet's Husband, Jason Momoa. Momoa is married to Lisa Bonet, who divorced Kravitz in 1993. We love a copacetic blended family, especially when the beautiful celebs involved are Lenny Kravitz, Jason Momoa, and Lisa Bonet. In the new November cover story for Men's Health, Kravitz opened up about the strong relationship he's established with ex-wife Bonet. The two divorced in 1993 and share daughter Zoe Kravitz, 31, and her husband, Momoa. The couple married in 2017 after 12 years together. They share kids, Lila, 13, and Nakoa Wolf, 11. People can't believe how tight Jason and I are, or how tight I still am with Zoe's mom, how we all relate, Kravitz says. We just do it because that's what you do. You let love rule, right? I mean, obviously, after a breakup, it's work and some time, healing and reflection, etc. But as far as Jason and I, literally the moment we met, we were like, oh yeah, I love this dude. And there's a photo, very charming photo, of Lenny Kravitz and Jason Momoa. Lenny Kravitz is wearing a tuxedo and his bow tie is untied. He's got his hand on his hip and he's sporting some shades. Jason Momoa is wearing a white tank top and some slacks. And he's got tattoos on his arm and a necklace, long hair. And he's got a camera draped over his body. This is far from the first time the two have been open about their close relationship. Last July, Kravitz told The Times that Jason was like a brother. In a 2018 Instagram post, the Aquaman star revealed that he and the rocker got matching skull rings. And during Zoe's June 2019 Parisian nuptials, when she married Carl Glusman, both men were present for her special moment. We've also come to expect Kravitz's annual Happy Birthday Instagram post to the 41-year-old Momoa every year. The most recent was this past August. Happy birthday at Pride of Gypsies, he said. One family, one love. All right, this article is called Prince Harry and Meghan Markle have reportedly decided to stay in California for Christmas this year. The COVID-19 pandemic and related travel restrictions are only part of the reason the Sussexes plan to stay in the United States for the holidays. A source close to the couple told Vanity Fair that the Sussexes don't have any plans to fly back to the United Kingdom for the holidays this year, in spite of earlier reports suggesting that they hope to do just that. At this stage, they are really enjoying their new life in California and their new home, the source explained. There are currently no plans for them to return to the UK for Christmas. Part of the reason behind the Sussexes' holiday plans is, of course, the COVID-19 pandemic, which has made transatlantic travel complicated at best. But, according to the Vanity Fair source, the pandemic isn't the only reason Harry and Meghan decided not to make the trip back to the UK. Apparently, Harry's ongoing rift with his brother Prince William also played a role. Let's just say that while things are better between Harry and his brother, it's not what it was. And I don't think anyone is ready for a cozy family Christmas right now, the source added. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. Be sure to listen next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ann Jordan, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.